Hi, everybody. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. It is Monday, November 23rd, 2020. Welcome to this Thanksgiving week broadcast. This is an open forum, so we're going through a series of chapters in my new book. And in between each chapter, we have an open Q&A, which means we'll take questions, what's left over from the chapter that I just went over in the previous broadcast. But you're also welcome, if you're attending to live, to submit any questions that you have. If you're listening to this on the podcast, you can always send questions to webinar@evoketherapy.com, and we'll be happy to put those into the broadcast, and you can listen to them on the next live Q&A. So with that, I'm going to get to the questions as my moderator, Malia, passes them on to me. Feel free, if you're attending live, to submit them at any time. She'll hold them in a queue until I get to the next one. So here I go. I'll begin. I'll start off right now. Somebody writes, our 16-year-old, now at a therapeutic boarding school, told us in family therapy last week that he is considering reporting us parents to Child Protective Services for abuse. We told him we want to support him in doing whatever he feels is necessary to help him heal. And while it hurts so bad to feel that after all the work we've done, he still hasn't felt fully heard, I was almost immediately able to go to a loving curiosity and ask myself, what is he trying to tell us? Later, I was able to kind of celebrate that, because 6 months ago, I would have tried to convince him otherwise, thinking he was crazy, or it was crazy. I was literally not triggered in the same way. Still, do you have any nuggets on how to approach this? Questions to ask. He is incredibly homesick and is counting down the days to a Thanksgiving home visit. First of all, I don't know who wrote this question because I don't see the names. She just passes them on to me when it's my turn to listen to them. But I must tell whoever wrote this how impressed I am with your work. I think to be able to have the wherewithal to avoid the trigger, to at least respond to the trigger in a thoughtful, flexible way, is absolutely gold. So I'll say first and foremost, congratulations. And really, you're modeling for everybody that's listening to this broadcast what it means to develop capacity as a parent. And the fact that you went to curiosity, and you could contrast that with how you felt 6 months ago, all of that is absolutely beautiful. And you deserve to be complimented on your progress, and really have it pointed out that that's a rare kind of level of functioning. The questions that you begin to ask is, what does he want? What does he need? What's he hoping to gain? And the fact that, you know, think about this for the rest of you who might be new to this. If your child thinks that they're legally being abused, wouldn't you want them to report whoever was doing it? If that's the process they need to go through, do you see how this parent's capacity is helping the child to understand that he or she is allowed to have their feeling and their perspective, and they don't have to have somebody else check it off and tell them that it's okay to feel or think what they're feeling and thinking? Do you see how magical that is? See, we can't tell our children to stand up to bullies. We can't tell them to assert themselves. We can't ask them to show up and be their honest selves if we're not willing to let them do it with us. I had one father one time many years ago describing a dilemma about his daughter. I think she was emerging young adult, and he was talking about how if she came home, that her old boyfriend would absolutely take over her identity like he had in the past. And as I was discussing this with the father, and he was trying to find out what ways can I challenge her, confront her, help her to wake up so she sees that this place that she's going, I don't want her, he said, I don't want her to be so susceptible to that kind of pressure. And as we talked about it, I illustrated, I said, by allowing her to pursue her own truth, while you still have your boundaries, but by allowing her to pursue her own truth, don't you see how you're really teaching her more than any other lecture could give her? You're teaching her that it's okay to stand up to people, especially you. We're not very effective when we give our children lectures about peer pressure if we're using those same tactics to control them. So I don't have a lot of other things, just following that same track. Like, what can we do? Is there anything you want from us? You know, and you don't remember, folks, when you ask that question of somebody that you love, in this case, a child, what can I do for you? Is there anything we can do to support you? You don't have to do what people ask you to do. You're allowed to say, in fact, it's critical for you that you learn to say, here's what I can and I can't do. So I think openness and curiosity, I think sometimes I have this thought too. I don't know if it applies in this exact circumstance, but I want to give you all another tool that I don't talk about maybe as enough as I should, it's okay to say to a child when they have a feeling or a thought that varies from yours, it's okay to say to them, I completely respect where you're coming from, but I might not be able to give you what you need. And I might fail at this. I might not be able to, and I'm really sorry that I can't fix this for you or make you happy. So to apologize for the fact that you might not be able to come through for them in the way that you want while still setting a boundary is a really, really powerful way to do it. So I think you're doing fantastic. I think you're establishing boundaries. You're developing a sense of self. I'm talking to the parent right now. I think you are right on track and virtually need no additional coaching. And there's nothing, just continue to follow that line of thinking. And continue to understand that it's okay for you to have a boundary or a disagreement, but still be absolutely compassionate. And I was talking to somebody recently, when we have to make villains out of the people in our lives, even our children, to set boundaries, that tells us that we come from a context where we have to be right. So it's okay. What you're doing is right on track. And thank you, not just for the question, but for the model that you're showing to us. Somebody says, admittedly, we're new to the program. I feel like the setting the boundaries has not been the problem, but the reaction to boundaries from our children, and are the problem. Our older child is in college now. She pushed boundaries, but adhered to boundaries better than our son who joined your program last week. How should I think about setting versus enforcing boundaries? Let's talk about ideals first and foremost. Ideally, this is what we work towards and we fall short of. Ideally, it's okay we want to try to not set it from a reactive, emotionally raw place, right? We want to set it where our prefrontal cortex, the higher level of our brain is still online. If we're doing it from a place of flight, or freeze, or fight, right? That reactive primitive brain, that fight or flight part of our brain. If we're operating from that place, we lose flexibility, creativity, insight, and so forth. And so we don't get to control how they react. We get to control how we react. And I must say very, very clearly, we're all going to come up short with this. This is not one of those things. In fact, the last series of posts that I did on social media, I made this point. At the end of the day, you're going to fall short of the ideal. And so then you can learn to apologize. And with that apology, your children perhaps learn the most important lesson of all, which is what it means to be a human and to have the strength to be accountable without overwhelming shame. So you don't get to control how they react to boundaries. You just get to control your boundaries. And children, parents, you know, others, they're really not going to celebrate your boundary keeping, right? As we, as humans shift to become more boundaried and anchored in solid values and principles with their own life, their own perspective, the people in your life aren't going to celebrate you. That's going to be the exception to the rule. They're not going to applaud you and encourage you. They're going to feel hurt, confused. They're going to accuse you of being selfish, uncaring, absent, ridiculous, emotional, controlling, whatever it is. They're going to find a word that you don't want to be accused of being, and they're going to choose that word because they learn from you that that's the one thing you're guarding against and don't want to be. So you try to set it from a flexible, reasonable place, like meaning that your prefrontal cortex, the mature adult part of your brain, is in charge. When you don't, you apologize, but you can't really control their reaction to it. It sounds like you have a good handle, a good hold on things. Next question. We as a society seem quick to medicate. My son is a transracial adoptee. He has understandably real sadness and depression related to his adoption and loss of his birth family and otherness, which at 16 doesn't feel great. How can we determine what might be clinical depression that requires medication and that which can be abated or helped with therapy? Wow, that's... Sometimes you guys, your questions are so amazing because you ask them in such a way that it even demonstrates how nuanced you've become in this process. It's a complex and layered question. The simplest answer I could put to you is that if therapy can work adequately, without medication, then we would opt for the therapy to work. And of course, the qualifying word is adequately. And who decides that? I guess it's a combination of you, the professionals, your child when they're under 18, and when your child turns 18, ultimately your child. So if therapy is working adequately, then we can skip medications, which come with side effects, right? It's always a measure of the upside and the side effects. That's kind of the way that we think about it. Now, you know, if you have a hard time, or your child in this case, has a hard time getting out of the starting block, you know, waking up, developing and maintaining enough motivation for therapy to stick and to move forward. If we have if we're limited in that way, that we can't even make use out of therapy, then medication to reduce anxiety, to stabilize mood, to decrease depression and increase motivation, that can be appropriate. So it's a very personal decision, and it's a very complicated decision, and it's unique to each individual. And it ought to be, the answer to the question ought to be developed in a dialogue with you, with your child, and with the professionals that you know and trust. You know, some are really obvious. Some people are obviously in need of medication because they're not able to get out of the starting block. That's obvious. And there are others that they seem to be making movement with therapy adequately. And so why add medication to that equation? But the ones that are in the middle and the gray area, it's a very personal decision that you have to make thoughtfully in dialogue with your child, especially if they're a young adult, but obviously even if they're an adolescent, and with the therapists and the professionals that are helping you. And you deserve nurturing support from professionals. You deserve intelligent answers. You deserve a nuanced dialogue. You deserve to ask difficult questions, very difficult questions, and have intelligent answers. So that's the way that I would answer it. But you, even from your question, it seems to suggest that you're there, that you're thinking at that level. Somebody said, it is difficult for me to divorce right from self when I feel my foundational ethics and standards are based in scripture, law, leadership, fundamentals, alms, giving, etc. How should I digest discovering self founded in the morals stated above versus right founded in the same morals? Great question again. I guess the point is, for you, they are. But you don't get to impose your religious beliefs on others. You can do that. We can do that somewhat with our children. We can require our children to come to church or synagogue with us or the mosque with us. We can all require that. But at some point, as a parent, if we are to follow what psychology teaches us about healthy child development, at some point it becomes the child's choice. And whether or not they want to adopt your eating practices, for example, if you belong to a religious practice that has certain principles around eating, right? If they want to practice certain worshiping principles that you practice and believe in, then, you know, it's up to them. And psychology and child development would say that there comes a point and you get to decide when that is, when you turn that over to them. But if you're constantly imposing your morality and your source of morality on them, we look at what costs can come of that, and they're quite great. So it's fine where you find your truth. You're allowed to believe it, to live it. It's about whether or not you want to impose it on somebody else. That's the first thought. I think the second thought, because I've worked with people who have wanted me, I've worked with parents who have wanted me to either overtly or maybe subtly impose a belief system on their child. That's not the way they would say it, but it's there. We want our child to become Christian or practice the Jewish faith or so forth and so on. And so what I talk about is how research and practice shows us that it's important to give children agency, to give them choice, that you can have your boundaries as you want them. But it becomes dangerous to kind of impose a belief on somebody. But, you know, you can do more harm by imposing than any specific belief would suggest. It takes away their sense of self. They're going to become susceptible to peer pressure. They'll lose who they are. They're not doing it then for the right reason. So there's a whole bunch that goes on when we impose ourselves on our children. And you know what's more effective? Practical in nature. When I was going to church, I don't attend church regularly, but when I did attend church, one of the things that I would teach in the Sunday school class that I taught was that I think the commandments are not necessarily a thou shalt, although that's the language that they use. But I said, I like to think of them as, this is what works. This is what works for you to have a happy, meaningful life. And I said, when I would teach this, that shift from moralistic, from imperatives, you should, thou shalt, to shifting it to, this is what I think works. This is my experience. And part of life is you get to experiment with right and wrong yourself to see what works for you. That approach, that shift in approaches is much, much more effective at getting people to where you want them to go. That connecting and healing trauma and deep compassionate love and listening are all better facilitators to get your children where you want them to go. So, and lastly, I'll answer the question this way. You know, I have two thoughts I want to share with you. The first one is, I was asked this question many years ago, and I brought it to a mentor, to a supervisor, because I was stuck when I got asked the question. And my supervisor said to me, you know, Brad, you have an advantage. You can tell whoever asks you that question, say, you're not a priest or a pastor or a rabbi or a cleric or a reverend. You're not any of those things. You're a therapist. And so that's your language. And so in a way, it becomes the client's responsibility to reconcile their faith with what they're being taught or what they're coming to understand about psychology and child development. Somebody said to me when I was much younger that there's a record in the scriptures and there's an experience that you have. Both are telling you and teaching you truth. And it becomes your job if you choose to pick it up, to find out how to reconcile those two things. And this person who told me, I won't repeat it to you, but I'll tell it to you. He said to me, when I was asking him the question, he said to me, I'm not going to apologize for asking you to solve a difficult equation. That's part of what faith and what thinking require. So I hope that helps. I hope that helps you. That's how I've made sense out of it. Someone says, could you talk tonight about the cadence and purposes behind the impact letter? I'm working in my internship with a lot of court-mandated DUI clients in early recovery, so I'm curious about these processes from the client perspective, how they aid in the healing process. Yes, I can. First of all, if there was one assignment at Evoke, and there's not one, there's many more than one, but if there was one assignment at Evoke, if I could only choose one assignment, it would be the impact letter that children write to parents. This is how you, Mom and Dad, impacted me. It's more important than the letter of awareness. It's more important than the hopes and intentions letter, even, that the parent writes to the child. It's more important than the response to the hopes and intentions letter, or to the war story letter, or to the, you know, on and on and on. Because what we basically think is, I read this quote yesterday. In fact, I'm going to look it up on my phone. I read this quote on the internet yesterday, and it said this. It says, it is not trauma-informed to tell survivors to stop playing the victim. I'm going to read that again. And maybe you can write it out because it's so short, Malia. It is not trauma-informed to tell survivors to stop playing the victim. So what we learn from that, because that's true, it's not trauma-informed to tell clients who have suffered trauma to stop playing the victim, is that in therapy, everybody's a survivor of some kind of trauma, some a lot more chronic or a lot more severe than others, but everybody is there because they're masking wounds with self-medicating symptoms. And so to point out to somebody that they're playing the victim is really an old line from our culture that's telling somebody not to feel. It's kind of gaslighting. You would justify it because you're saying, well, the language that they're using is very helpless. Well, that's what people feel like who are suffering from mental illness and addiction issues. They feel like they're getting screwed in life. They feel like people are out to get them. So the question becomes is, do you want to hear the truth from your child, or do you want to hear the right answer? Because those are your two choices. Obviously, there's a continuum, but essentially, do you want to hear the truth, or do you want to hear the right answer? And so when I have clients write the impact letter home, I let it go pretty. It tells me about their story, even if they're in what some would call a victim's mindset. I would rather have somebody tell me the unmitigated truth from their perspective than I would have them try to figure out the right thing to say that I will find acceptable. So the impact letter becomes for me this cornerstone of therapy that says, I want you to have a safe place to tell your trauma story, small or large trauma, right? I want you to have a safe place to tell your trauma story as a starting point. So I like it relatively early. I don't need the hopes and intentions letter that parents write. I don't need it to hit the kid over the head. I did when I was younger. When I was younger, I liked it for shock value, and I liked it as a wake-up call to the child. But I think wilderness therapy is enough of a wake-up call inside of it, you know, in and of itself. So I don't need a sledgehammer for a hopes and intentions letter. I need to create a space where the child feel safe to begin to tell their story. And at first, they're okay to tell it immaturely, in an unevolved or uninsightful way. Over time, once that story has been heard, we can start to talk about ways of coping or dealing with the pain, the sadness, the grief, the loss, the trauma, the suffering that's come out of that story. So for me, it's you know, when I do it is when I think that they're going to take the assignment seriously. You know, when I think it's going to be a worthwhile discussion or starting point. I have a quote that I've used before in the past saying, you know, listen to children when they're lying to you. If you listen to children, even when they're lying, but you're listening carefully enough, you can hear the truth behind, beneath the lies. Listen to the lie that somebody tells you, like they're telling you about a dream. Because what we learn from dream interpretation is that it's in the ears and the eyes of the beholder of the story, right? The audience, where the magic happens. So allow for some wide ranges. Try to understand the story from their narcissistic, primitive place that they're writing it from, if that's where they're writing it from. Give it some space. Don't ask for perfection. Don't hold it to a high standard, at least not the first or the second version. Open it up. The accountability is implied in the context, especially in wilderness therapy. The accountability is implied. The accountability is that you're not going to rescue them or change the circumstances or go out and fight their battles for them, right? The accountability at the end of the day is, at the end of the day, even if they're, it's like what I used to say in the beginning, when I was first a wilderness therapist, you know, children were telling me how, what idiots their parents were. And at first, I thought my job was just to be a really clever psychological detective and find out where everybody's fault lie. And after a while, I realized, after going through several of my first clients 25 years ago, I realized everybody's an idiot. That's not the mystery. I'm an idiot. You're an idiot sometimes. And so tell me about the idiots that raised you. And my listening, my empathic, deep listening will suggest on an unconscious level, especially when I don't look for clarification or perfection, will imply on an unconscious level, it's not about the idiot, it's about how you deal with the idiot. Because your professors are going to be idiots, your bosses are going to be idiots, your coworkers are going to be idiots, your spouses are going to be idiots, everybody knows that. Your employees, coworkers are going to be idiots. Your children are eventually going to be idiots. The trick in life is not to figure out who the idiots are, because they're all around us. They're sitting in this chair right now broadcasting a webinar or podcast to you. That's not the mystery. The real question in life is, how do we deal with other people? And then we learn about boundaries and communication. We learn about all of the healthy coping tools that are out there for us. But when we fight with their narrative, when we argue with their narrative, when we stand our ground. Now, there are times when you can challenge a narrative, but not right away, not when somebody's raw, not when they're fight or flight, not when the primitive brain is upregulated, when their nervous system is upregulated. Those aren't the times to challenge the narrative. The time to challenge the narrative gently is once you've reduced the activation of the central nervous system, once the brain is not on high alert, once their trust, once they know that you're safe, non-judgmental, and that you care about them. And that comes later. In my opinion, all of the magic, all that makes me successful as a therapist, to whatever extent that is, it based in my ability to hear somebody's truth and to hear it at the deepest level, even if the facts don't line up with reality. The story is telling some kind of truth. Even a lie is telling some kind of truth. So that's what I would say about the cadence of it, It's also long term. You know, if you have two or three sessions because you're working in an EAP, if you're just meeting somebody once, you're probably not going to get very far along this journey. But in terms of a long-term attachment and a long-term relationship, that's the trick, to listen and listen deeply. I hope that's helpful. Next question. I have heard you speak on finding your tribe, but what can you offer about maintaining relationships with loved ones who are addicts actively in denial? Sometimes you have to step away. Finding your tribe is not limited to the blood that you share. You know, finding your tribe is, I've said this before, that if my children, as they grow up, if they tell me that being around me is toxic, 100 times out of 100, I would encourage them to take care of themselves, to set a boundary with me, to cut me out of their life, if that's what they believe they need to do to feel okay in this world. But the very idea of allowing and respecting somebody in that way would make me a safe person. Why would you want to leave somebody who can see you, can hear you, can respect your needs, even if your needs in this example resulted in them cutting you off? If you have a relationship with somebody like that, you don't want to leave. You want to grab on. You never want to leave that person. You've found your tribe. So, you know, there's a saying that I've talked about before, that a Buddhist teacher once told me, that to grow up, you have to learn to kill your parents, metaphorically, of course. And what I said back was, I think to grow up, you have to learn how to kill everybody. So this idea of finding your tribe is what Freud described the goal of therapy to be, was freedom. And what he meant was freedom from unconscious obligations. So in therapy, the rules, I was watching two shows recently in the last 10 days, two great dramas on Netflix with my wife. Two totally different shows, different plot line, different story, different context. But there were two different scenes that hit me. One was a family, you know, a family of three, mother, father, and a late teen daughter sitting at the kitchen table in what I would think would be around the 1960s, mid-1960s. I think that was the time frame. And I remember watching this family and all of the unspoken angst at the table, the silence, the rules of the patriarchal hierarchy in the family, the rules about children and women, even the rules about men, what men should feel and think. I could just feel it in this silent scene. And I remember thinking, as the camera pulled away from the scene, I remember thinking, these people are all in prison. And they're bound by rules that are stupid rules about how we should be. Similarly, I saw another scene later on, different context. Mother, father who didn't live together, it was a holiday celebration, and two adult children. Same kind of scene. See, folks, what's keeping us stuck? What enlightenment is, and what keeps us stuck? What keeps us stuck is we think that there are rules that we have to follow. And what we know about progress is that sometimes you have to break the rules. If that weren't true, then we wouldn't have the cure for a lot of diseases. We wouldn't have found out that the earth was round or that the earth revolved around the sun. You know, at one point, those ideas were heresy. We wouldn't know about social justice issues. You know this, that some of the most moral people that have ever lived have broken the rules of, you know, the law of the land, or broken with tradition. So there's a kind of a private rebellion that we have to go on inside of ourselves. Enlightening is unlearning. Enlightening is and is realizing that the messages that you've received from the dominant culture are not necessarily true. And when you find people who are opening up to this, when you find people that don't know your truth, that don't give you advice, but can listen, when you find people that are non-judgmental, because, hey, we all have crap and life is really hard, you found your tribe. And if you live in a context where family members are mistreating you in the ways that I'm describing, that might not be your tribe. But you get to decide. You know, I wrote that article again, Malia. I think it's relevant to this question. I wrote the article a couple of years ago and just posted it on social media again about why you shouldn't go home for Thanksgiving. I was making this case. You can post the link again, Malia, why you shouldn't go home for Thanksgiving. Because what I'm saying is it's okay. You're allowed to stay away from people in your life who abuse you, who don't treat you the way that you want to be treated, you need to be treated. And again, think about this, folks. I know it's hard for us to conceive of that idea in relationship to us, because our experience of us is that we love our children more than anybody. So we will always assume that we're good for them. That's our blind spot, right? But remember this, that relationship and idea becomes a template for the rest of their life. And if we operate with that idea that we're good for them and we love them, that's what people are going to tell them in their life who abuse them. They're going to be fooled by people who say, I care about you. You should do this or should do this or shouldn't do that. I hope that answers the tribe question. All right. Can you explain your experiences with individuals with oppositional defiant disorder? How is it diagnosed and treated? Yes, I can. I mean, it's a pretty simple diagnosis. Any of you could look at, if you just Google the diagnostic and the DSM, which stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, it just lists 9 or so things. And you have to qualify for 6 of them, for example. I don't know with ODD what the ratio is, but they just give you a list of things. You can do that with narcissism, depression, anxiety disorder, oppositional defiant. There's a need for oppositional defiant individuals. Our rebellion becomes an identity because they're fighting against a couple of things. They're fighting against being swallowed up. They're often fighting against shame. One reaction to shame is to violate every norm and rule. So people that are sometimes the most abusive are incredibly deeply shamed. So it comes out sideways. Oppositional defiant disorder is seen, there's a relationship between ODD and a lack of empathy for other people. But here's the trick about a lack of empathy. And this goes for all of our children. This is something that is not intuitive. The cure to a lack of empathy is not teaching people empathy. The cure to a lack of empathy is attachment, attunement. The cure to a lack of empathy is to helping the individual feel their pain deeply, regularly, sensitively. Because when individuals are allowed to and learn to feel, they recognize feelings in other people. An absence of empathy is an absence of connecting to another person's humanity. And that often begins because our own humanity has been compromised, either because we've experienced trauma and we cut out the sensitive feelings as a way to survive, or we weren't listened to, or we were gaslit, dismissed. So you teach somebody how to feel. So again, with oppositional defiant disorder, you get curious and you start to understand that there are deeper levels and layers, and that our what we would call common sense cultural messages about somebody who's oppositional or lacks empathy or is a sociopath or a narcissist or borderline, virtually all of our common sense notions about those things is wrong. That you don't cure narcissism by knocking the person down to size. You cure narcissism by creating a competing experience for the narcissist where their humanity is recognized and felt and held. So ODD is kind of a precursor to becoming antisocial personality disorder, which used to be called sociopathology. And the way you treat it is by teaching somebody to feel. And if you want a non-clinically technical example, watch Mr. Rogers. Watch the movie about Mr. Rogers that Tom Hanks starred in, or the documentary about Mr. Rogers, which both came out, I think, earlier this year or last year. And watch what he does with children's anger. Watch what he does with his own anger. He allows it to be. When you're allowed to feel, you don't have to act it out sideways. And anger is hurt and fear's bodyguard. Rebellion is a kind of last resort. Violence is a last resort. Martin Luther King said that rioting is the language of the unheard. When we feel powerless, when we don't feel heard, when we don't feel connected to, violence comes out. We're trying to express ourselves through that. Now, it deserves to be monitored and contained. But once that's happened, we have to connect to the humanity of the person acting out to help them connect to it. And once one connects to one's feelings, one recognizes those feelings in other people and becomes sensitive to them. When those feelings are denied or ignored or repressed because they're too painful, one sees other people as things, objects. In essence, once one becomes an object, one turns other people into objects. Once one becomes a person, one sees other people as persons and responds to them as people. Thank you for putting the link, Malia. Somebody says, can you please talk more about why you urge parents to attend 6-12-step meetings while their child is at Evoke? What does attending these meetings accomplish for the parents? Couple of things. The first thing that it teaches you is what it feels like to be your child. To walk into a literal or a virtual room with strangers and to be asked to talk about and tell your story. If you learn nothing else from attending a 12-step meeting, you learn what it's like for your children to be put into a therapeutic program and to be asked to talk about their feelings, their vulnerable, authentic, and raw self in front of strangers. Risking, of course, that they'll be judged, rejected, seen as less than. Okay? So that's the first thing you learn, is you have empathy. But the second thing you learn is you learn a philosophy and a culture based on a group of people who love people who are behaving in self-sabotaging, irrational, and dangerous ways. How do I love the people in my life who are addicted or struggling with mental health disorders? How do I love them? And essentially, really what you're learning, I mean, there's a hack here that I don't always tell you. You're really just learning what it's like to be a person, because it's in those relationships, in those dynamics where you love somebody that you can't save or control, where you love somebody that you can't fix or solve. It's in those moments that we learn what it means to love another person. So that's what you learn. You learn how to love. You learn how to love is based first and foremost on developing a sense of yourself, healing your own trauma, becoming a boundaried person. You really just learn about relationships. you know, those groups are set in the context of having addicted loved ones. Some have a slightly broader umbrella under which they operate, but that's basically it. But really, it's just about learning to relate to other people. It's about what it means to be a person and love another person. So that's why we want you to get some exposure to it. It's also free. You can call a sponsor any time of day or night. It's not a formal therapy session. It's surrounding people that are communicating and sharing in this kind of sensibility that we're talking about on these Evoke webinars and podcasts. You know, it's just saying, this is the way somebody who has boundaries and a sense of self would think about this situation. So you're learning how to think differently than the way that the dominant culture teaches us, which is very, very flawed. So that's what it does. Our son is at an aftercare since 3 months ago. And while he was twice at Evoke before, the therapist is telling us that he's doing a switch. He's doing really well. I have a hard time believing it after so many years of struggle. Can we take the luxury and rejoice? What should we expect? Just hold it lightly. The highs aren't that high and the lows aren't that low. Take a step back and take a we'll see attitude. That's my suggestion, encouragement. The bad moments aren't as bad as we usually think, and the good moments aren't as good as we usually think. But when you detach, this is important. I don't think I've ever said what I'm about to say on one of these podcasts or one of these broadcasts. When we detach, folks, we don't just detach from the pain. We detach from the exuberance of the celebration of the high points. Right? We take a we'll see attitude. It's about not gripping the roller coaster so tightly. It's about relaxing, letting go, and surrendering. So we'll see. I never believe when kids are struggling that they're as bad as their struggles. And I never believe when they're having a highlight that they're as good as their successes. We're somewhere in between, right? Mostly in between our highs and our lows. So hold it lightly. Just like I'm saying, be curious about the struggles, be curious about the successes. It's okay to be suspicious. There's a great line from a book on brain spotting, which gave me great confidence in the model of brain spotting, written by Dr. David Grant. And he said this, and I love this quote, this idea. He said, any theory that does not take into consideration the client's inclination to please the therapist is inadequate. Any theory that does not take into consideration the client's inclination to please the therapist is inadequate. So your lack of excited exuberance over successes and highlights is as important as your lack of reactivity during the low spots. You're saying, this isn't about me. Yes, I love you and care about you. And if you do something that I think is going to benefit your life, I'm going to be happy for you. But you get quieter. It's like you're watching your child. You're in the stands at a ball game, some kind of game, watching them. You don't want to yell so loud that they get distracted by your cheering or your criticisms. Just blend into the crowd and applaud lightly and wait and watch. Detaching applies to the highs as much as it does the lows. And the people that forget that, that really hook on to the highs, the child knows that that's just the other side of the same coin. That if I have to maintain this high for everybody in my life, especially my parents, to be excited, when I make a mistake, what am I but garbage? Then I'm a failure. If my parents can be proud of me, then they're going to be disappointed in me when I fail. And we want you to kind of be curious in both instances, ideally. All right. Next question. I've spoken to many parents and teens who who's I've spending I've excuse me, I'll start over. I've spoken to many parents whose teens have completed EVOK and described it as life-changing. What exactly can that mean? What can parents reasonably expect in terms of measurable changes following a successful experience at EVOK? My understanding was that anxiety and depression can't be cured, but can better be managed. The hope that I think they're describing is that the process changed them. Yes, their child developed some skills, some tools. They watched their child have some success. They watched diagnostics improve and treatment planning come into play that can be helpful. But I think what parents are talking about is it changed everybody. When you shift your focus, this is something I've said many times. When you shift your focus away from what you can't control, which is your child, to what you can control, which is you, you are free. You are empowered. You have hope. If you focus on what you can't control, you'll have anxiety and depression. If you focus on what you can control, you'll have hope and optimism. It can be challenging and at times overwhelming to realize how much you have to work on. But it's the only hope you have. So I think what people are telling you when they talk about it being life-changing is that they had an experience that was transformative for them. And that people weren't necessarily cured, but now they understand the project. That's what I think people are describing. You get new eyes and new ears. You think differently. And even if your child experiences no dramatic change whatsoever, you feel differently about it because you understand it differently. You have a different relationship to your child and to their problems and to your problems. So I think it's about a fundamental shift, a fundamental transformation that goes far beyond skills or improvement in a diagnostic category. But it's a different way of thinking and being. It's a different sensibility. It's a different level of consciousness. I have time for one more question. Is there a process similar to the impact letter that a parent can use to invite an adult child to share his or her experiences from childhood? Is it best done as part of a process guided by a therapist? I mean, the impact letter can be anybody, anywhere. Let me clarify that. We don't encourage parents to write impact letters to their children. Children can't handle your trauma. I know that a lot of programs and therapists say, tell your children how you feel. I won't go into this in depth tonight, but I have you pause with that. Your children aren't meant or built to carry your feelings. It's heavy and overwhelming, but we are meant to carry their feelings. So encouraging people to write an impact letter, asking for it, giving them examples. Brad Reedy, I know some of the things that make it difficult to live with me. I know some of my traits, my characteristics that make it difficult for my wife and children. I know that. I don't know all of them. Some of them are unconscious. Some of them I'm too ashamed to face, I'm sure, but I have a good sense of some of them for sure. Start with those. If I were my son, if I were my daughter, if I were my child, here's how I might feel. And it's about developing a culture where mom and dad don't have to be good. I was going to tell you a skill earlier and I forgot it. It's okay. When you have a reaction to a child, it's okay to say, you know, my first gut reaction is X or Y, but I'm learning with therapy to do Z. So in that way, you're being honest about your reaction. I'm triggered by finding out that you're cutting. I'm triggered when you told me you lied. I'm triggered when you said you want to become a tattoo artist. That's the old Brad. That's the old dad. That's the old mom. That's the truth. What I'm learning is that it's not my job to live your life. So that's a new skill and a new tool for tonight too. You're honest about your reaction, you own it, but you talk about the new way you're trying to be because of what you're learning. And that can be really, really helpful. All right, I think we're at the end of the question. So we'll save the rest for the next time. Thank you for joining me. Let me go over a couple of things. We have some spaces in our online and upcoming in-person intensives. If you want to do a deep dive, email intensives@evoketherapy.com. Pursuit trips are family trips or young adult trips. Think of sober fun or therapy light kind of activities, but camping, fishing, canoeing, kayaking, snowshoeing, skiing, ice climbing, whatever it is, whatever you want to design, but then a light therapeutic support system. We have online support groups for our intensives program. If you're an intensive participant, our next one is December 8th at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. For wellness clients is November, we just passed November 19th. The next one will be December 3rd. So we have support groups online for former parents, former participants. You're welcome to attend. Like I was just talking about, we ask you to attend 6 12-step support groups while your child is with us. That's just to get you, to get your feet wet, to get an experience with it. And they're not all the same, so try a different couple of meetings. Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, Adult Children. You can also go to refugerecovery.org or NAMI.org to find out about more classes, resources in your area. All of these podcasts are available, all of these broadcasts, excuse me, are available the next day on our YouTube channel and on our podcast app. So any podcast app, just search Evoke Therapy, finding you, and Evoke Therapy Podcast. We just passed 1 million listeners Saturday morning. So 1 million listens Saturday morning. We're really excited about that. You can also go to soundcloud.com. On Twitter and Instagram, you can find @EvokeTherapy or @EvokeTherapyIntensives. On Facebook, you can search Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. And then the Evoke Therapy blog and the foundation, which we're going to restart the foundation. If you're interested in joining a board, if you want to participate in a board that raises money to help people that can't afford therapy, you can contact Malia at evoketherapy.com for more questions or information on the reorganization of the board that's going to be happening over the next several months. My two books, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are available on Amazon. The audiobook for The Audacity to Be You is finally out. So I read it this time in my own voice. If that makes a difference to you, it's on Audible, on iTunes, or on Amazon. My next broadcast will be December 1st, so I'll be off for this week, the rest of the week. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for your great questions. I hope this is a helpful point of contact. Remember, this will be available mid-morning tomorrow. If you have a podcast app, go there, find Evoke Therapy Programs podcast, subscribe, and it will alert you when new podcast episodes are uploaded. So that's a way to kind of get a notification. Go to any of your podcast apps, subscribe to the Evoke Therapy, which is called Finding You in Evoke Therapy Podcast, and then you'll get notifications on your phone when the newest podcast is released. All right, folks, thanks for joining me. I hope this is a helpful point of contact. Have a great week. I hope you have a safe and happy Thanksgiving. I'll talk to you next week. Take care. Bye-bye. Better year you'll be. Better. Slowly chose.